place some teaching, some trainings, DBT, IOP, PHP, so that we not only just throw them out, but the players don't need to be abandoned right now. They need to be offered tools to manage their
DeJuan Smith-Williams, I want to thank you very much for being with us. That does it for our broadcast. Democracy Now! Produced by Mike Burke, Renee Feldstein, and Guster. I'm Amy Goodman. Happy birthday to Sam Alkoff. Thanks for joining us.
You are listening to KBOO Portland, 90.7 FM, 91.9 FM Hood River in the Gorge, 104.3 FM Philomath in Corvallis, and of course online at www.kbu.fm. Stay tuned for the Tuesday evening news.
Two years ago, Portland lost a musical and cultural icon with the passing of Ghanaian master drummer, bandleader, and teacher Obo Adi. His contribution to the raising of local knowledge and appreciation of African music in general, and Ghanaian music in particular, and his tireless work with local youth cannot be overstated. As part of our fall membership drive, KBU is proud to present a celebration and retrospective of Obo's work on Thursday, October 2nd, from 1 until 4 p.m. Musical offerings, remembrances, and interviews will be part of this important figure's legacy. Join Andy Hosh and DJ Charlie and others at 1 p.m. on Thursday, October 2nd. The preceding hour, from noon until 1 p.m., will be filled with Ghanaian music as part of DJ Charlie's regular World Beat Connection time slot. See you then.
Community Radio is proud to co-sponsor the Robin Jackson Band Music Video Release Party, Friday, September 19th at 9 p.m. The Robin Jackson Band debut music video will be released, featuring members of March 4th, Vagabond Opera, and tons of Portland characters.
Also performing will be electro violinist and producer Mr. Moo and soul singer Morena Massa.
Again, that's Robin Jackson Band Music Video Release Party, Friday, September 19th at the Secret Society Ballroom, 116 Northeast Russell in Portland.
More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
Coming up on the KBOO Evening News, a wildfire near Estacada threatens homes as it expands over 3,500 acres.
Portland Public Schools agree to hire new teachers, but students and parents say that it's not enough.
The FBI launches a facial recognition program across the country. Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Tuesday, September 16th, 2014. I'm Emily Young.
And I'm Andrew Geller. In the midst of overcrowding in many Portland public schools, the school district expects the number of students around the city to increase by 1% this year. Schools handling the biggest increases may be able to hire additional teachers. However, only $2.4 million out of a $16 million budget has been allocated for these new hires. The remaining money will be put in reserve. This move has generated public discussion of Portland Public Schools' decisions on how and where it will spend the money. Tonight, Portland Public School District Superintendent Carol Smith will speak to the school district board. She will address the budget plans along with her efforts to boost early literacy, increase graduation rates, and cut back on suspensions and expulsions.
President Barack Obama made an announcement today that he is sending 3,000 soldiers to West Africa to combat the Ebola virus. It's unclear how the soldiers will help the situation, as the government of the affected nations have been requesting health workers and equipment, not military aid. Obama said that stating that preventative measures are needed to combat the Ebola outbreak started, Obama said that stating that preventative measures are needed to combat the Ebola outbreak. The Ebola outbreak started in December 2013 and has claimed the lives of thousands to date, from Sierra Leone to Liberia to Senegal, and taken the lives of three top African doctors in the last 3 months. Locally, organizers with Oregon Association for Liberia are planning a rally at the First Unitarian Church in Portland on Friday, September 19th. KBOO's Sequoyna Wright spoke with one of the organizers, Nathaniel Kirkula, this afternoon. That was
My name is Nathaniel Kirkula, chairman of the Oregon Association for Liberia in Oregon and Southwest Washington State. We are stationed fundraiser and also creating an awareness about the Ebola situation in Liberia and West Africa.
And why is it that your organization wants to focus in on this? What are the connections between your organization here and in West Africa?
We are from Liberia, and we have our families, our loved ones, and the people. We're all connected to the people in Liberia as a community here. And as I can tell you today, three families within the community in Oregon have lost about 18 people. So that kind of struck us so much that we had to do something about it. And so that's why we came together as a community to see what we can do, rally around, because we've heard on the news that they're running out of supplies. They don't have adequate materials to work with. So we're organizing ourselves and come together and see what we can do for the people of Liberia. So that's why we're trying to stage this rally and see if we can get the support of the public, the government officials, and everybody else to join us. Because the Ebola, we don't know when the next outbreak is going to be, but it's the best time that we can work together to eradicate that from that part of the world, from West Africa.
And President Obama just made an announcement today that 3,000 troops will be sent to West Africa to help contain the deadly virus, and he says to see about preventing it from spreading to the United States and across the globe. What are the local Liberian folks' opinions around on that?
You know, we were very much impressed and happy that such a thing. Now, we know that the world did not turn a blind eye on us as a country, a small country like Liberia. And the way we are spread so rapidly, so fast, we did not, you know, see that coming. You know, so with this, what the president has done, you know, we know that we got hope that our people are going to be okay. They're going to have preventative care. They're gonna teach the people how to take care of themselves, what, and to be able to treat the sick people. And I hope by this time we'll have enough supplies, and that will encourage nurses and doctors to come and join the effort and to help our people. This thing is way bigger than our community, is so small. We're just, you know, whatever way possible we can do something at least to help our people. But with the president, the way he came through with the announcement made today, you know, we are so happy, and we know that our people are going to get all the help they need. But equally so, we as a community here, we want to use this occasion to educate ourselves about the Ebola. We don't know much about it. That way, when we call our people back home, we'll tell them exactly what we know and how they can prevent themselves. So that's one of the main reasons of this awareness.
All right. And the rally for this is on September 19th at the First Unitarian Church, correct?
That's correct.
All right.
We're going to be there starting 4 p.m. And we're inviting everyone, you know, the public at large, to come and join us, because this is very informative. People have a lot of doubts about what's going on. We don't understand anything. So with the doctors coming in, they're going to help us understand what Ebola is and how the effects are, and what can we do to help our people to understand something about this Ebola.
That was Nathaniel Kirkula of the Oregon Association for Liberia speaking with KBOO's Sequoyna Wright.
Backers of labeling genetically modified organisms have added extra funding for the push for the requirement to label genetically modified foods, which will be voted on this November on Oregon's No on 92 ballot initiative. Farmers were among those at Justice Begins with Seeds, an event this past weekend in Portland. For more on this story, we turn to KBOO Sequoia Wright in conjunction with Oregon News Service.
Some Oregon farmers set aside their harvest plans for a couple of days to learn more about a growing trend known as food sovereignty. The term means having more local control over foods grown and sold in an area. At a weekend conference in Portland, hundreds debated the merits of a food system dominated by industrial agriculture and focused on convenience, high yields, and global sales. It may be churning out a lot of food, but is it as safe or nutritious as it could be? That's what Chris Hardy is asking. He grows vegetables, herbs, and seed crops near Talent, Oregon.
If you believe that there's nothing wrong with the food supply, you know, and look around at the amount of obesity, you don't even know who grows your food. You don't know how it was produced. We're kind of dumbing down our culture.
On one issue that received a lot of discussion is Measure 92, Oregon's upcoming attempt to require labeling on genetically engineered food ingredients. Hardy farms in one of two counties that voted to prohibit the use of genetically modified seeds and says he sees ingredient labeling as a natural next step.
You know, if the majority of the people, citizens of Jackson and Josephine counties, one of the most conservative regions of the state of Oregon, believe that genetically engineered crops should not be allowed in their farming systems in their counties, why don't we label them?
Ivan Maluski, who heads the Friends of Family Farmers Coalition, says his group has decided GE labeling would have a side benefit for Oregon agriculture by making local products stand out.
We're proud of what we do. You know, having these labels on GE foods helps people distinguish, you know, Oregon-grown products from a lot of the stuff that might have come from other parts of the country where they're more reliant on genetic engineering in their agriculture.
At least 8 field trials are underway in the state using genetically modified seeds, from food, crops, to flowers. Their proponents say they're created to be more disease-resistant and that nutritionally, the foods made from GE crops don't differ significantly from other foods. For KBOO Evening News, in conjunction with Oregon News Service, I'm Sequoia Wright.
Firefighters reported making progress Tuesday against the 3,500-acre wildfire that has been burning since Saturday, about 10 miles south of Estacada. Expanded fire crews are taking advantage of cooler weather, calmer winds, and higher humidity to build lines designed to contain the fire. Meanwhile, at least 40 homes on the fire's southwest flank have been ordered to evacuate. Another 120 households have been warned to pack their bags and to be ready to evacuate. The Lazy Bend Campground and Work Center, Silver Vox RV Park, and the Lady Flats Off-Highway Vehicle Area were evacuated on Sunday. The Red Cross has established a shelter at the First Baptist Church just north of Estacada, where about 25 people spent Monday night. The fire has been dubbed the 36 Pit Fire after a quarry near the source of the fire. In most cases, fires are named after the closest geographical location by the first incident commander on the scene. The cause of the fire remains under investigation, but Forestry Department staff say they believe it was human-caused.
And Clackamas County commissioners approved an emergency order today allowing the county to seek state assistance for response to the 36 Pit Fire. The order allows formation of a local incident command to provide support to the affected areas and residents. The 36 Pit wildfire has been burning since Saturday afternoon and did prompt several local evacuations. The emergency declaration also allows for several steps, including closing or barricading streets or roads, limiting traffic, evacuating people from the affected area, implementing mutual aid agreements, and expending funds to respond to the emergency.
A record 550 square miles of forest has burned this year in Washington state. This is almost 6 times the 5-year average. The burned area is about 5 times the size of the Portland metro region. Portland's Metro land area is just over 130 square miles. This includes Clackamas, Multnomah, and Washington counties. Washington Governor Jay Inslee is asking for federal help in paying for a number of uninsured homes lost to the fires. In addition to the Washington fires, at least five wildfires are now burning in southwest Oregon. Today, Oregon's Department of Environmental Quality issued an advisory that air quality in Portland, Salem, and parts of the Willamette Valley is unhealthy due to wildfire smoke. People with sensitive respiratory systems are advised to take precautions.
Last night in Wilsonville, the city council voted to approve an ordinance taxing the sale of marijuana and marijuana-infused products in the city. The vote followed a public hearing on the ordinance, which was unanimously approved on its first reading. The ordinance is similar to marijuana taxation ordinances passed by the cities of Ashland and Hillsborough in anticipation of potential voter approval of a statewide marijuana legalization measure on the November ballot. The measure imposes a lower tax rate on medical marijuana than that imposed on recreational marijuana, but it does mark the first time that medical marijuana will be taxed in the state. City staff indicated that taxing marijuana may cause a reduction in the potential number of sellers in the Wilsonville area. They pointed out that such sellers may choose instead to operate in cities without such a tax. The public hearing was held open in order to allow for further public testimony, and the second reading of the ordinance is scheduled for Monday, September 29th at 5:30 p.m. at City Hall in the Council Chambers.
In the crib, got two kids and my baby mama late. So I had to did what I had to did, cause I had to give.
You are listening to the KBOO Evening News. Stay tuned after this newscast for an interview with Dan Handelman with Oregon Cop Watch, followed by Out Loud at 6. Tonight's Out Loud welcomes the Portland Sister of Perpetual Indulgence to talk about the support around education and development of the LGBT community. At 7, it's Hard Knock Radio news and views from a hip-hop perspective. Tomorrow's weather is a slight chance of showers with a high of 76 degrees and a night low of 60 degrees. Today in history, on September 16, 2013, hundreds gathered at the 16th Street Baptist Church in Alabama, which was bombed in 1963 and murdered four black girls by members of the Ku Klux Klan in 1963. Three of the Klan members were later convicted of the bombing. The quote of the day is by socialist historian and Pan-Africanist W.E.B. Du Bois, "The cost of liberty is less than the price of repression."
So I had to did what I had to did, cause I had to give. I'm up all night, getting my money right, until the blue and whites. Now the money coming slow, but at least a nigga knows slow motion better than.
It's almost 5:18 and time for daily commentary from Jim Hightower.
Here's an unusual uber-rich guy with an unusual message for his fellow 1% of the 1%ers. Nick Hanauer, who made billions as an internet entrepreneur, recently wrote in an open letter to other uber-richies that, quote, "The true job creators are middle-class consumers, not rich business people like us. America is dependent on a strong middle class," he says, "for it's their purchases that power the economy," noting that, "I earn about 1,000 times the median American annually, but I don't buy thousands of times more stuff." He points out that his family has 3 cars, not 3,000. So, Hanauer says, it's in the self-interest of America's corporate and financial elites to do all they can to lift wages, starting with a $15 an hour minimum wage. The old claim that paying workers more will destroy small businesses and halt job growth is simply not true, he says, adding that it's insidious to claim that helping the rich get richer is good for the economy, but helping the poor get richer is bad for it. Hanauer points out that, quote, "The two cities in the nation with the highest rate of job growth by small businesses are San Francisco and Seattle, which also have the two highest minimum wage levels in the country." To the coke-headed ideologues who say any minimum wage is just too much big government, this member of the Billionaires Club says the soundest way to shrink government is to decrease the need for it. Pay decent wages so people don't need food stamps, rent assistance, and other subsidies for life's basics. This is Jim Hightower saying, Hanauer concludes with this sobering warning to obtuse billionaires. No society can survive the glaring inequities we are building into the American economy. Stop these futile low-wage policies and bridge the widening divide, or, quote, the pitchforks are going to come for us. You can reach Nick Hanauer at nick@secondave.com.
What do the corporate powers from Wall Street to Walmart have in common? They hate the Hightower Lowdown. You can see why at www.hightowerlowdown.org.
In New York today, two Bronx police officers, Joe Ocasio and Joseph Murphy, were convicted of an assault misdemeanor and harassment violation. A damaging videotape surfaced showing the two giving a 17-year-old Tyree Davis a beating following his arrest for disorderly conduct. After Davis was detained and released from the local precinct, he gave the arresting officers some words. The pair then followed him out of the building and beat him in an alley. The case made it through the DA's office after being brought up by Internal Affairs. The officers did not face a jury. Rather, they went up in front of a judge who refused to convict them on simple assault charges because the bruises Davis suffered were not severe. The police may face dismissal. They have been on administrative duty since the event in 2011 and are now suspended. They may yet do time. Sentencing is set for October 28th.
An 83-year-old anti-drone activist has been found not guilty for engaging in a direct action in upstate New York. Immediately after the prosecutor rested his case against D.C. activist Eve Titas, DeWitt Town Judge David Gideon granted the activist's motion to dismiss. Ms. Titas represented herself pro se with the support of D.C. attorney Mark Goldstone. The 83-year-old activist was arrested in April of 2013 along with 30 others as they stood reading aloud the preamble to the United Nations Charter and the First Amendment of the United States Constitution. The activists were standing on the edge of the driveway leading into the Hancock Reaper drone base in the town of DeWitt. The prosecution's video of Ms. Titas' arrest showed the arresting officer grabbing the Constitution from her hands and tossing it aside. When police ordered her to stop, Ms. Titas continued her reading aloud, facing the base, saying that she was expressing her First Amendment right to peacefully, quote, petition her government for redress of grievances. She referred specifically to what she called war crimes being committed by the weaponized Reaper drone robots piloted over Afghanistan by the Hancock attack wing. The activist trial is one of the ongoing series of trials of those arrested in April of last year. The trials are expected to continue through the spring of 2015. Many will be jury trials due to the misdemeanor charge of obstruction of government administration. The next jury trial, that of Bronx Catholic worker Mark Colville, will take place this Thursday, September 18th.
The FBI has announced that it is ready to launch its nationwide facial recognition identification system. The facial recognition program was launched 3 years ago, and the FBI says now it's fully operational. The facial recognition program is part of the Next Generation Identification System, which is set to replace the FBI's National Fingerprint Database. Though it's not really an either-or with fingerprints and face recognition, as the new system seeks to collect many forms of biometric data. Critics point out that with the growing prevalence of surveillance cameras, it will not be long before Americans walking down a street in any city or town may find their biometric information being run through the FBI's database automatically and without consent. As part of NGI's full operational capability, the NGI team is introducing two new services, WrapBack and the Interstate Photo System. WrapBack is a functionality that enables authorized entities the ability to receive ongoing status notifications of any criminal history reported on individuals holding positions of trust, such as school teachers. Law enforcement agencies, probation and parole officers, and other criminal justice entities will be advised of subsequent criminal activity of persons under investigation or supervision. The Interstate Photo System will provide the nation's law enforcement community with an investigative tool that provides an image-searching capability of photographs associated with criminal identities. They will use facial recognition to identify people. The FBI describes the system as, quote, investigative enabler, unquote, which raises questions about how the system is applied to finding someone who is not in the database because they have yet ever to be arrested. It's unknown where the information came on these individuals will be obtained by the FBI, though some have speculated that DMV databases of driver's license photos may be one source.
And now we hear the latest in worker-related news from laborradio.org.
You're listening to WIN, Workers Independent News, a production of Diversified Media Enterprises. I'm Doug Cunningham. In a remarkable speech to its Missouri branch, AFL-CIO President Rich Trumka said confronting race in America is vital as justice is sought in the police killing of Michael Brown. Trumka said the labor movement is intimately involved in Michael Brown's death.
Leslie McSpadden, Michael Brown's mother, who works in a grocery store, is our sister and an AFL-CIO union member. And Darren Wilson, the officer who killed Michael Brown, is a union member too, and he's our brother. You see, our brother killed our sister's son. And we don't have to wait for the judgment of prosecutors or courts to tell us how terrible that very thing is.
Trumka said racial candor and understanding are needed that recognizes the awful reality of the dangers young black men face from police nationwide, even as the police officer who killed Brown is given full due process and on-the-job rights in the investigation. And Trumka acknowledged the history of racism in America and in the labor movement, as he called for the demilitarization of police.
We can't militarize our police. A free society is policed by a civilian police force, democratically accountable to the community that it protects. Let's not forget what our history teaches us, because it's always the employers who want the paramilitary forces, the National Guard, the bayonets and the armored cars, and the weapons always end up pointed at us.
The National Labor Relations Board has ordered CNN to rehire 100 former union employees and pay compensation to 200 others to make all the workers whole after illegal anti-union actions 11 years ago. NABIT CWA called on CNN to immediately comply with the NLRB ruling. CNN is required to restore any collective bargaining work that was outsourced. CNN also must recognize the workers' union locals and resume bargaining with them. The NLRB found that CNN had engaged in, quote, widespread and egregious misconduct and had demonstrated, quote, a flagrant and general disregard for the employees' fundamental rights, end quote. Machinists working on the Golden Gate Bridge staged a one-day unfair labor practices strike Tuesday that did not impact bridge traffic. The machinists are part of the 13-union Golden Gate Bridge Labor Coalition. The coalition is trying to reach an agreement on a new labor contract with the bridge district. The unions say after giving concessions in 2012, they're looking for raises that actually keep pace with the expensive cost of living in the Bay Area. The Association of Flight Attendants, CWA, is announcing an early out program to help resolve staffing issues at United Airlines. It offers flight attendants up to $100,000 to voluntarily separate from the company. The union says it offers real options to flight attendants while expediting negotiations that are underway at United. The union says early out also recalls workers on voluntary and involuntary furloughs. You've been listening to WIN, Workers Independent News. For more information, visit laborradio.org.
And now we go to Paul Cienfuegos for a weekly segment on taking back our authority to govern ourselves.
Greetings. You're listening to the new weekly commentary by yours truly, Paul Cienfuegos. Last week, I shared some details about the 8 active community rights campaigns that have been launched in Oregon over the past few years. Here's a very brief summary. 8 Oregon counties are now moving forward with locally enforceable laws that will be placed directly before the voters, starting this November in Josephine County, where voters will have the opportunity to ban all corporate and government spraying of pesticides on forest and farmlands. Benton and Lane counties plan to ask voters to ban all GMO planting of seeds. Columbia County's group is working to put before the voters a complete ban on coal and oil trains passing through their communities, as well as prohibiting the export of coal and oil from Port westward near Clatskanie. Newer community rights groups exist in Yamhill, Lincoln, and Marion counties. Here in Multnomah County, we also have a very active community rights group, which meets every 2 weeks, and which I co-founded with others in January of 2012. It's much harder in a big city trying to decide which corporate activities are most dangerous and obnoxious to local residents. Is it the endless new corporate big box stores that keep popping up? or the hundreds of corporate cell towers still being proposed across the city, or perhaps the thousands of local homeowners who have lost their homes due to illegal foreclosure proceedings by the banks? Or is it the dangerous oil trains that now pass through Portland every day? Or maybe it's the endless aisles of GMO food sold in grocery stores that are the biggest problem here. Or maybe it's the Portland city government's ridiculous, unnecessary, and imminent shutting down of our beautiful and historic open drinking water reservoirs and the suspicious activities happening in the Bull Run watershed that many folks think is a sign that more logging is being planned in our drinking water shed. Or perhaps the biggest problem we face is losing our right of privacy as the NSA and giant corporations collect and aggregate and resell our personal information and email and Facebook communications without ever asking us first if we're okay with them doing so. The list is truly endless when it comes to corporate activities that are of great concern in any major U.S. city. In the near future, our Portland group intends to pick one of the issues I've just mentioned, and then we'll be launching our own city or countywide ballot initiative campaign, which, as you can imagine, will be a huge undertaking. Anyone can join us once you've attended one of our monthly, free, two-hour orientation workshops. You can find out more about our Portland group at communityrightspdx.org. Those of you who are listening to my commentary today may be thinking that this sounds like pure fantasy, the idea that a community can actually get away with prohibiting harmful corporate activities rather than simply regulating and permitting them. But believe it or not, 160 communities in 9 states have already passed legally groundbreaking local laws that ban fracking, water withdrawal for bottling, sewage sludge dumping on farmland, unsustainable energy development, factory farms, and so much more. All of these local ordinances create new, directly enforceable rights for people and nature and enshrine the inherent right of a community to govern itself and to protect its own health and welfare. Imagine your community learning how to do this. And isn't this a more empowering and compelling form of citizen participation than the endless pleading and begging of power holders to stop the latest corporate outrage that is our current form of citizen activism? You've been listening to the new weekly commentary by yours truly, Paul Cienfuegos. You can hear future commentaries every Tuesday on the KBOO Evening News. I welcome your feedback. You can subscribe to my new weekly podcast at communityrightspdx.org. You can sign up for my newsletter at paulcienfuegos.com. Thanks for listening, and remember, we are the people we've been waiting for.
More than 200 garment factories have shut down in Bangladesh since the country's worst industrial disaster in April of 2013. According to an industry group report, a massive building collapse prompted a major cleanup of the world's second largest textile sector. But activists say the problem of sweatshop-produced garments in Bangladesh continues, and the government has not adequately addressed the issue. The director of the Institute for Global Labor and Human Rights, Charlie Kernahan, spoke with the Working Families Radio Network about the production of designer jeans in Bangladesh.
If we actually have the power to tell 80% of the country that the Trans-Pacific Partnership is in the works and what it is and why it should be opposed, we have a power I didn't know we had because...
Well, that 80% is activists. I mean, those are speaking to activist audiences, and I think that's a very important, actually, point because, you know, you have to look at information spreading and activism and mobilizing spreading almost like a archery target, you know, with concentric circles. And the initial circle is a small core group that, you know, gets a topic and starts to spread the word. It goes to the next circle, the next circle, the next circle. And now, I think it's now beyond the activist community that we have. And what's also interesting is when we start to do that, we start to get the message out about something like a TPP, for example. We'll just take that as an example. Then we force the core media coverage. And so as we've seen the activist community get educated, organized, and mobilized around the TPP, it forces the corporate media to comment on it and report on it because otherwise their credibility just shrinks even more. So they're in this very interesting position with shrinking credibility, and we're increasing our credibility and our readership and viewership. And so as we get things out, we actually can push the corporate media into covering something they hadn't covered. For example, we did this amazing action at the U.S. Trade Representative which is where the negotiation of the TPP comes out of, or the White House. In fact, it's, the building is right across the street from the old executive office building, the White House complex. We did an action. We covered their building in massive banners. Four massive banners, you know, 20 feet was the smallest one. And we did it at noontime, right across from the White House, with the intense security and able to pull it off. And it forced the Washington Post to cover it, saying it was the greatest guerrilla action ever. And it meant pictures of the banners were all in this big spread and inside the Washington Post as well as on their webpage. They even linked to a video that one of the activists working with us produced in their column. So we forced the media to cover it by just, you know, making it such a big noise that they had no choice and they'd lose credibility.
And yet there's still a section of the public to be reached, a few of whom may be listening to this program. Could you just give us the three or four worst bits of the Trans-Pacific Partnership for those who might not yet have heard and haven't made their way yet to popularresistance.org?
Well, it impacts negatively every aspect of our lives, from food and water to the internet access, to finance, to power, the regulation of big banks. You pick an issue, labor, environment, they're all impacted negatively by this, and they make corporations more powerful than governments. We lose our local sovereignty to control local elections and local representatives to control how we protect our environment, protect our economy, and it's given over to this international corporate agreement. And it's being written by 600 corporate advisors, along with the U.S. Trade Representative, while it's kept secret from all of us, and mostly secret from Congress. Congress members have to go through a bunch of hoops to see it and can't take notes, can't take pictures, can't bring their computer, can't bring staff, can't talk about it because it's classified as a secret. And so we're all kept in the dark while 600 corporate advisors work with Obama to write it. So it's a absolutely horrible agreement. The good news is we're stopping it. They've been trying for over 2 years now to get fast-track trade authority, which would essentially allow Obama to sign the agreement before Congress reviews it, and then Congress has a very short amount of time to vote up or down with no amendments. And they've been unable to get fast-track trade authority now for over 2 years. Without that, they can't pass it. And as we fight that successfully, it empowers countries around the world to say no to the president and the trade representative on their corporate agenda, because they're empowered if they see that we're being successful. So it's a synergy between countries around the world gaining power against the United States and the people of the United States gaining power as well. So we're winning, but the next battles are coming up in late November after the elections, or early November after the elections, and then next year we'll see what the legislative makeup is. We'll have another round of battles. But we're on the verge of winning this. We've been successful 2 years now. We can keep winning, and it'll be a tremendous victory of people versus transnational corporate power. So we hope we can, you know, keep the record up.
Kevin Zeese, thank you for coming on Talk Nation Radio.
Thanks for having me on. Good talking with you.
This is Talk Nation Radio. I'm David Swanson. Take action at...
In the latest news from U.S.-occupied Afghanistan, a suicide bomber hit a NATO convoy in Kabul, Afghanistan, on Tuesday, killing three troops and wounding 13 Afghan civilians in one of the biggest blasts in the area for months. In a separate roadside bombing, three Afghan soldiers were killed. Also today, Taliban militants beheaded a religious cleric in a central province of Afghanistan. And Pakistani officials have claimed that three soldiers were killed following a cross-border attack by militants in North Waziristan. Pakistani officials say the attack was carried out on a Pakistani army post along the border between Afghan and Pakistan.
Here are some of the latest news and developments from Palestine via the International Middle East Media Center in Bethlehem.
Right now, we're talking about designer jeans in Bangladesh. You know, Charlie.
Welcome to Palestine Today, a service of the International Middle East Media Center at www.imemc.org for Tuesday, September 16th, 2014. At least 26 violations of the ceasefire agreement by Israel documented. Meanwhile, Israeli troops kidnapped 33 Palestinians during invasions targeting West Bank communities. These stories and more coming up. Stay tuned. Israeli soldiers invaded dozens of communities in occupied West Bank and in occupied East Jerusalem on Tuesday and kidnapped 33 Palestinians, including 10 children. Palestinian sources in occupied Jerusalem said that dozens of soldiers, police and security officers invaded overnight dozens of homes in different parts of the city and kidnapped 22 Palestinians, including 10 children. Six of the kidnapped children are only 12 years of age. Moreover, Israeli forces invaded dozens of Palestinian communities in different parts of the occupied West Bank, kidnapping 10 people. All of the kidnapped were taken to a number of Israeli military interrogation centers. In other news, a global research, Canadian-based think tank, announced in a report that 26 post ceasefire violations were committed by the Israeli army. On August 26, a ceasefire between Israel and the Palestinian armed groups in Gaza was mediated by Egypt, bringing a fragile end to the war which killed some 2,150 Palestinians, mostly civilians, and some 60 Israeli soldiers. According to global research, among the violations Israel committed was Israeli Navy broken the ceasefire by firing at fishermen on four separate occasions, not lifting the illegal blockade imposed on Gaza, and seized $56 million US dollars of Palestinian Authority tax revenue and killed a civilian in the West Bank. In the meantime, since the ceasefire, Palestinian armed groups has not fired a single rocket, attacked an Israeli target, or done anything to break the terms of the ceasefire, global research reported. In other news, three Palestinian survivors of the ship which sunk near Malta arrived safely in the country after trade ships came to their rescue. According to the survivors, Syrian, Palestinian, Egyptian, and Sudanese migrants set out from Dumyat, Egypt on September 6th, and were forced to change boats several times during the crossing into European waters. The traffickers ordered the migrants onto a smaller vessel, with many of the migrants fearing that it was too small to hold them. When they refused to change boats, the traffickers rammed them until they capsized. And that's all for today from the IMEMC News. This was the Tuesday, September 16th, 2014, news roundup from the occupied Palestinian territories. For more news and updates, please visit our website at www.imemc.org. Today's report has been brought to you by George Shmawi and me, Ghassan Bannoura.
You're listening to the KABU Evening News. This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we encourage your participation. Call us with your breaking news stories at 503-231-8032. The producer for tonight's newscast, as well as our engineer, is Sequoia Wright. Jenka Soderberg is the KABU Evening News and Public Affairs Director. A podcast of local stories from this newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/eveningnews, or look for us on Twitter at kboonews. If you'd like to call your elected representatives about any issue you've heard on the news tonight, here's your options. And we're going to skip that tonight. You can find that on the web. You're listening to KBOO Portland, 90.7 FM, K282BH Philomath, and 104.3 FM, and K220HR Hood River, 91.9 FM. I'm Andrew Geller.
And I'm Emily Young. Coming up tomorrow on KABU at 7, it's Democracy Now! With Amy Goodman and Juan Gonzalez. At 8, Paul Roland hosts Wednesday Talks Radio with a focus on the Cascade Media Convergence. At 9, on Political Perspectives, we speak with a representative of the Oregon Environmental Council about the People's Climate March in Portland on September 21st, and with Diane Hodiak, co-organizer of the Central Oregon Climate March. At 10, hear Air Cascadia headlines, interviews, and commentary with Chris Andre. At 10:15, it's Flashpoints Investigative News Radio with host Dennis Bernstein. At 11 on The Food Show, Sam Fromarts, a writer and sometimes baker, talks about his book, In Search of the Perfect Loaf. We'll also talk with Lisa Migrant, the owner and culinary director at Raven and Rose, about using the whole plant. And we talk with Liz Crane, who recently released the second edition of The Food Lover's Guide to Portland. Thank you, KBOO members, for your generous support. If you're not a KBOO member, you can become one by going to kboo.fm and clicking on Donate Today. Thanks for listening. Stay tuned for an interview with Dan Handelman, local police and accountability activist Dan Handelman, coming up in just a few minutes. Stay tuned.
KBOO News In Depth, where we take a deeper look at the top news stories impacting our community.
A number of Portland police directives are up for review this month, with public comments due back on September 30th. The directives that are up for review include crowd management and crowd control techniques, the role of the police review board, the discipline process for officers, and how the Bureau deals with performance deficiencies by police Bureau employees. Portland Cop Watch will be making comments on all these directives and is asking Portland residents to submit comments as well. We are joined live by Dan Handelman of Portland Cop Watch. Dan, can you tell us a little bit more about the directives that are up for public comment this month?
Yes, well, the Bureau's directive, that's what their general orders are now called, they cover a wide variety of things, all the way from what goes on their uniforms to what kind of force they can use. And the ones that are up for review at this point in time include crowd management and crowd control, which I think a lot of listeners in KBOO would be interested in, and about seven different directives have to do with internal affairs investigations, discipline, police review board, which we can talk about a little bit more in depth if you'd like, and kind of the way that the internal affairs investigation outcomes can be categorized, which there are several ways that they, when you file a complaint, that a case can be handled, and some of those outcomes are going to be changed a little bit by this.
Well, what's the current process for review and the discipline of officers accused of wrongdoing?
It's a very complicated system. If you file a complaint, the police, depending on how serious it is, you file a complaint actually through the city auditor's office, something that's called the Independent Police Review Division. And that's not part of the Bureau, so they have no ability to change the IPR's way of handling things. However, the city code kind of narrows what IPR can and can't do. So basically, they take in the case and 70 or 80% of the time, they just dismiss it out of hand and say what you said doesn't rise to the level of complaint. It doesn't violate the directives, even if it did, even if it was a valid complaint, or some other reason to dismiss it. The other 20% of the time, half of them are investigative, so about 10% of what comes in the door, and those actually get turned over to police internal affairs most of the time. We have not heard of any case filed by a community member that's been investigated by IPR since in January of this year, since they were given the quasi-authority to do their own investigations. So then your case gets handed over to internal affairs. And so that 10% are fully investigated. The other 10% are handled as what's called a service improvement opportunity. And we've been complaining about that term. Originally it was called a service complaint, and we said, well, this is not, you're not at a restaurant where you got a dirty fork, you know. It's not service a service complaint. This is a police officer did something that you think violated your rights in some way or another, and you filed a complaint about it. So even if it's not a very serious complaint, they should be referred to as a non-disciplinary complaint rather than a service improvement opportunity. What's clear, I haven't had a chance to review all of these directives yet, I have to say, right up front, as we're discussing what we want the rest of the community to do when they write in about them. But the one about service improvement opportunities is still called, still has that title on it. So we're pretty sure they didn't listen to our previous advice on this matter.
So which of those do you see as the main problem? Is it that most of them are just dismissed out of hand, or is it the wording?
I mean, oh no, absolutely. The dismissals is a huge problem, but that's not up for review right now. They're not the dismissals are coming from, as I said, the auditor's office. Yeah. There are a bunch of cases in addition to the ones that get dismissed by the auditor's office that get declined when they get handed over to internal affairs. So yeah, that's probably part of the directive. So these are all numbered with these kind of arcane numbering systems. Called number 330.00, the Internal Affairs Processing Directive, and I'm pretty sure that's where you'll find, to some extent, their criteria for what they think is a worthwhile complaint to investigate or not. But a lot of that is probably in a separate document somewhere that we're not even being given the ability to comment on, called the Standard Operating Procedures. So you know, it just gets more and more into the weeds that the more you try to improve the way they do things, the more they, you know, kind of move the ball around to make it harder.
Well, I understand that you've been attending these citizen review committees' crowd control work for about 2 years, and what do you see that they're going to address the main problems of this current process? What are you going to be able to?
To be clear, the directive about crowd control and crowd management. It's a combination of some very broad rules that the police have to use when they're out policing the streets, when people are exercising their First Amendment rights, and some very specific things too. There are mentions in the directive about the possibility of police using certain weapons and the mounted patrol unit. And for many, many years, we at Portland Cop Watch have said that you should not be putting horses in the middle of crowds. It does not work well. The horses get spooked, people get stepped on. It's not appropriate. And you know, anybody who knows a lot about horses will tell you that they shouldn't even be riding around on the streets, on the pavement, because that's really bad for them in the first place. But you know, they train these horses apparently by throwing bottles at them and things like that, and it just seems like a very cruel thing to do. And it's very intimidating, and horses weigh, you know, hundreds and hundreds of pounds, and I've been pushed up against a wall by one. I know people have had their feet stepped on by them. It's just not an appropriate thing. So we've been trying to get them to change that, for example, that, you know, the idea of bringing horses to crowd situations. And the Citizen Review Committee that you just mentioned, they're an advisory body that sits within the IPR that we talked about a minute ago, that's in the auditor's office. It's an 11-member citizen body that has the ability to review cases when people have a case investigated and they don't like the outcome, and they also can make recommendations about policies. So one of their policy work groups that they have been working on for, as you said, about 2 years now, is the crowd control work group, has been reviewing not only the Bureau's policies, but things that they found in other cities, reports that came out of some of the, like, World Trade Organization and other global protests, where a lot of cities came to the conclusion that, you know, when you show up in riot gear, it's going to make the crowd very antsy. So maybe it'd be better not to show up in riot gear. And to some extent, the Portland police practice that, but they still deploy the people in riot gear, even if they're a block away. No matter whether your event is peaceful or planned and has a permit or not. And so that's the kind of thing I think that people should be concerned about and should be looking at this directive to write in about.
So they make recommendations, but there's no real teeth there?
The Citizen Review Committee makes sure. Well, that's not really the issue. I mean, that's true. We don't know what the Citizen Review Committee is going to recommend because they haven't finished their report in 2 years. We've been sitting at these meetings and telling them what we think they should do. They generally have been ignoring us and saying, well, you're the only people that we hear concerns about horses from, and tasers, and beanbags.
Pepper spray.
And so we don't, you know, we're not going to include those recommendations because we're not hearing about this from other people in the community, which is actually not true because they started meeting shortly after Occupy Portland was pushed out of the parks downtown, and they did hear direct concerns about all those things. But they, I think they just forgot over the, you know, it's taken so long.
So
we don't know what they're going to recommend. But the point is that now the Bureau has, starting in April of this year, the Bureau has been posting some of their directors up, you know, a batch at a time and saying, hey, community, we would like you to comment on these. And they just posted these ones on September 1st, and the deadline to comment on them is September 30th. So
I have a question about that. How does this current public comment period relate to the Department of Justice agreement with the Portland Police?
Let me just finish explaining what community members can do. So you can go to the Portland Police Bureau's website, and actually you can go to the Police Bureau's website, and there's a DOJ tab on there, and there's a thing that says Directors for Comment and Review, and that's where you can find these things. And if you are willing to give your email address to the police, which, you know, is always a questionable thing, you can sign up on a list, and they'll email you at the beginning of every month when they're posted their new ones. One of the reasons they're doing this, and certainly would have been good practice for them to do years ago, is that the DOJ agreement says that they should post directives that are related to use of force, the discipline process, mental health issues, and other things that the DOJ investigation involved for community comment. And so, yes, this is kind of directly related to that in that sense. And for the first several months, they were posting them up, and you just kind of had to kind of know what was happening. You know, we had to go online and hunt around and look for them. And in fact, we missed the comment period on the first batch because the Bureau didn't actually send out a news release or anything saying these things are there for you to review. But some of them are going to be reviewed every 6 months, and some of them are going to be reviewed every year. If you miss this time, there's presumably another opportunity. But it seems to me that we should probably get in on the ground floor, as it were, you know, the first time they're reviewing these, and say these are the problems that we see and we'd like to see them fixed.
So right now people have until the 30th.
Correct. And today is already the 16th, so there's just 2 weeks left from today to write your comments.
Okay, and we'll give out that site again at the end of the of our time, but for people who aren't familiar with the settlement between the Department of Justice and the Portland Police, can you talk a little bit about that history?
Sure. Well, you know, we've had a lot of history in Portland of Portland Police shooting and killing people of color and people with mental health problems. When Aaron Campbell, who actually was suicidal and African-American, was shot in the back by Portland Police in early 2010, there was a cry from the community that we wanted justice, and the AMA, Coalition for Justice and Police Reform, reached out to the Department of Justice and said, we want a pattern and practice review to see whether there's racism and other anti-community biases from the police that are leading to all these shootings and deaths. And the DOJ did an investigation and came out and said, well, we can't prove anything about race, but we did find that in cases with people in mental health crisis, the police are using excessive force. They didn't point to any shootings. They pointed to uses of tasers and other violence, but not necessarily the shootings that have happened. Or the beating of James Chassis was, you know, predated their investigation by so many years that they couldn't include that either.
Right. There's just been so many. It's been so many instances, like the situation in Ferguson, Missouri. I see that we're running out of time, and I want to make sure that we get all that information out, but about where they can go to find out about giving comment, about where people can go about to find about that, but about the situation in Ferguson and what's happening here in Portland, like the recent tasing, I think just in the last day or so, of the young man in Northeast Portland.
Right, that happened on Saturday, and yeah.
North Portland in St. John's, that's right.
Right, exactly, and, you know, the police documents tell one story. We haven't heard the whole story from the community side yet. I think that it's unfortunate that these officers who went there apparently were trained in crisis intervention, which is one of the resolutions the DOJ agreement got for us, is, you know, how to de-escalate situations without using violence. And they decided to use tasers and engage in hand-to-hand combat with the young man that they ended up tasering and bringing into custody.
That's terrible. Well, Dan, if people want more information, where can they find it?
Like I said, the directives are posted on the Police Bureau's website, which is called portlandpolice.com, and they have a tab that says DOJ on it, and you can find those directives there. If they want to email us, our email address is copwatch@portlandcopwatch.org. And I mentioned to you earlier today that tomorrow morning, Wednesday morning, at 9:30 in front of City Council, we're going to be speaking to the mayor and council about a number of issues, including use of force and oversight systems and such, because we were denied a meeting with the mayor over a period of 5 months. And we decided to sign up for these three-minute, what's called communication slots. So at 9:30 on Wednesday, we will be there. City Council members of the community can be there to support us. That would be great.
And where's that again?
At City Hall, which is at Southwest Main and 4th. Downtown, and we will be in the City Council chambers at 9:30.
Well, thank you, Dan. I've been speaking with Dan Handelman of Portland Cop Watch about Portland police directives up for review this month, with public comments due back on September 30th. Dan, thanks very much.
Thank you.
John Coltrane. Every September, KABU Community Radio celebrates the birthday of John Coltrane with an all-night marathon honoring Coltrane's life, his legacy, his influence on musicians around the world, but mostly his music. Tune into KABU this Friday night, beginning at 10 p.m. as we celebrate John Coltrane's 88th birthday with an 8-hour marathon, rare recordings, interviews, and some new releases. That's this Friday night from 10 p.m. until 6 a.m. Coltrane Night, a September tradition only here on KBOO Portland. And remember to join us the following Tuesday night, September 23rd, John Coltrane's 88th birthday, as KABU Night at the Clinton features The World According to Coltrane, beginning at 7 p.m. Tuesday night, September 23rd, a celebration of the 88th birthday of John Coltrane. John Coltrane. Every September, KABU Community Radio celebrates the birthday.
What's up, everybody? This is Goddess and She, and you're tuning in to KBOO Portland. Holla at your girl. What's up, everybody? This is Goddess and She.
This KABU program is made possible in part by KABU Foundation members and a grant from Portland's Gay Directory, providing a resource guide of